Thank you very much. Right, so let me remind you where we stopped yesterday. So let me restate some of the results that I mentioned last time, and then I'll tell you what the plan is, okay? So we ended up with an inductivity theorem for the attenuated transform associated with a connection. So let me remind you about that one, okay? So let me label it, theorem A. And this was myself, Mikko, and Gunther. And it went something like this. So if you have a compact, simple surface, suppose you have a compact, simple surface, and suppose that you have a unitary connection, so let A be a unitary connection, and by that, let me just remind you that this simply was a map A. The way to think about this is sort of map A into the Lie algebra of the unitary group, and the whole point of this is this was a one form, so it was linear in the velocities. Okay? So once we have that connection, once we have that matrix of one forms, we have a connection, as I did explain last time. So suppose on the trivial bundle, so we have, suppose you have such a connection, and let also F be of a very simple form, F of X be just a function of X plus a one form. So F, a smooth function on M, and alpha, a smooth CN-valued one form. And suppose that this F is in the kernel of the attenuated Rey transform. Then the F is very special. Namely, the bit that depends on the position has to vanish identically, and the one form is a very special thing. The one form ends up being just simply DAP, where P is a smooth function from N into CN, vanishing at the boundary. And let me also remind you what DAP was, just using precisely the definition of the connection. So DA of a section is just simply DS plus AS. And let me just sort of remind you about this. So we have a section, it's just a function from M taking values in CN, and if you apply DA, you get a one form, a CN value one form, yeah? Because this bit is a one form, and then A is a one form, yeah? And this. So let me also remind you the definition that we were using for the attenuated transform, okay, a little bit. So the idea to define this attenuated Rey transform, which I try to indicate that it does extend in a very natural way, the usual attenuated Rey transform that many of you are probably familiar with, is just simply to say, to define IA. So what you do is you solve the transport equation I will remind you about this briefly, with initial conditions U on the on the negative part of the unit tangent bundle being zero, and then the definition of IA of F is just simply U on the positive bit of the unit tangent bundle. So let me remind you also about the picture that we had. So we had our compact simple surface with the outer normal nu, and the vectors pointing inside were the plus vectors, and the vectors pointing outside were the negative vectors. So essentially, this sort of transport equation is a package, is a sort of first order PDE in SM that essentially packages the information of solving the related linear ODE along every geodesic. So the way you have to understand this, so try to explain, because I tend to forget that I have to explain these things. But so the A is a function on TM, so it has an entry XV linear in V. Outside. So I put the minus here and the plus.
Go from outside to inside.
The way I define this one, yes. Yes. So I specify this final value here to be zero, and I look at the value at the beginning. Yeah, you can do it one way or the other, but that's the convention that I have taken. What was I saying? Yes. So remember, the connection has an entry in X and Z. So here, this is the vector field X of the Jurassic flow being applied to the function U. So U is a function from SM into CN, and here we have to understand that this is, you know, maybe it should be a little bit more explicit, A of X V times U, yeah, equals minus F. Okay, and if you were to do this in the scalar case, if you were to do this for N equals to 1, I wrote down the formula last time, you get the usual formula, where the attenuation depends linearly on the velocity. Perhaps it's more familiar to have attenuations that depend only on x. We have dealt with that case as well, but I'm not saying anything about this at the moment. I don't even know if I'm going to say anything more later, just because I don't want to mess up your train of thought. But because I'm trying to show, you know, the essence of the proof in this simplest non-trivial. No, to define this, the f could be an arbitrary, that's another good point, the f could be an arbitrary function in CN. If you want to define the attenuated rate transform of an arbitrary function in SN, you just do this. You can certainly define it. The thing is that, no, you can for the definition, you can do it for any f. To get an interesting result, you assume that the f is of the form, you know, something of degree 0 plus something of degree 1 in the velocity. Okay? Right, so is the statement clear? Yeah? Right, and then what I did do that last time, let me just remind you, is that this theorem A, I sort of explain as a reduction how this theorem A implies the following theorem B, which I'm just going to state to remind you, because that was sort of the motivation, saying that if you have a compact simple surface, and you have two unitary connections, with the same scattering data. So the scattering data was, you know, you saw the parallel transport beginning at the identity and you end on something. If they have the same scattering data, then they are gauge equivalent. So namely, there exists a U from M into a unitary group such that the U is the identity on the boundary and they are gauge equivalent in this sense. Where again, let me just remind you that this DU is, if we have a function of S, then DU is the one form associated to that function. Okay, so this gave a full answer in the two-dimensional case for the problem of whether it is true that the parallel transport does determine up to the natural abstraction, up to the natural gauge equivalence, a unitary connection. Yes?
What about the valid for general F?
Is theorem A is valid for general? No, well, okay, so, yeah, we have a more general theorem, which I also didn't state because so, if you have an arbitrary F without any condition on the velocity, I don't think there's much you can say. Then the correct question would be to say, well, suppose now that F is a polynomial of some degree, let's say degree N. Can you understand the kernel in that case? Yeah? So, the answer is yes, we can understand what the kernel is. It is essentially, you know, if you look at the transport equation, the kernel is basically what we can prove is that if this has degree K, we can prove that the corresponding U has to have degree 1 less. Yeah? So everything which is, you know, of degree 1 less vanishing on the boundary that if you apply x plus a to that u, will give you an f that is in the kernel, and these are the only ones. Yes, I mean, in some sense you can interpret this. Yeah, so you can interpret this in some way where a lot of these results as replacing, yes, as replacing the rank cohomology by flow cohomology with a geodesic flow. That's the way I see it. We don't have an application, as far as I know, of the result for an arbitrary degree, so I guess that's why we kind of left it somewhere. It is somewhere in our files, but yeah, I mean, we don't have a nice application like this one, theorem A implying theorem B, but like this, but you know, if anyone has something in mind, I'd like to hear. Okay, that's more or less where we stopped last time. So really what I want to do today is prove theorem A. Just before I launch into that, I need to do some justice and mention some previous results on this. So, no surprise, kind of like one of the first results is due to Sharafutdinov. Yes.
You replace the C in the RAM by the X?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So, in fact, if you have a flow, you can always talk about flow cohomology. So, you see that two functions are flow cohomologous if they differ in a full derivative along the flow. What we call in dynamical systems a coboundary. And this is a very important notion in dynamical systems. And this is related to the elliptic theorem that Dima Burago meant. I have a discussion with him that I would like to make sort of extensive to everyone at some point, but I'm leaving that for, I think, lecture 4, which is what we'll discuss in detail the closed case.
So
yes, the book by Katok and Hasselblad, An Introduction to Dynamical Systems, should have quite a bit of stuff on that, I would guess. No, any time. I mean, it's much better if you interrupt me, if I... It's much more useful for everyone. Doesn't matter if I don't make it wherever I want to make it. Okay, so Sharafutdinov in 2000 proved... around 2000, yeah. Proved a theorem, and proved... nothing like theorem A, as far as I know, but proved theorem B under a strong assumption on the connection. So he proved theorem B, assuming A and B have are C1 close. To, it's a strange sort of hypothesis, to another connection with a small curvature. So in particular, if they're very close, let's say, to a trivial connection, that's true. Now, one advantage that I should say is that he does this in any dimension. Okay, then a little bit just at around the same time, Finch and Ullmann, I think the published paper is 2001, they consider theorem B with flat background and they're able to show theorem B always, so they prove theorem B, so theorem B for flat background and A and B with a small curvature. Which is an improvement over Sharafutdinov because Sharafutdinov needs the connections themselves to be C1 close and they go to just curvature being small. And then There's a paper by Grigory Efkin. This is from, I think, 2004, in which he does the flat case, flat background. Yeah. But his proof is completely different to what we do. The metric G's. Yeah, when I say flat background, I mean, oh yeah, sorry, the flat metric. Yes, so let me just be a little bit more precise, thanks. Flat G. Yeah. And Finch and Ullman, they also do flat G. Okay, finally I should mention, even though it's not exactly the same setting, No, but it has to be C1 close to something very close to flat. So they are very nearly flat. They have to have some more curvature too. Two dimensions. Thank you very much. So this is 2D. The only thing that is arbitrary dimensions is Sharapudino. This is 2D. And then finally I should mention the work by Roman Novikov. This is 2002, in which he discusses again flat G, but he doesn't consider the case of simple manifolds. He considers the case of all R2, and the connections are not compactly supported, but they have some decay at infinity. Connections have decay at infinity. Have suitable decay, which I don't want to explain. But the main point that surfaces here is that if you don't assume compactly supported, but you just assume some reasonable decay, then you start having ghosts. So what do I mean by ghosts? Well, I mean transparent connections, for example. It would be in this case that you can have a connection whose scattering data is the identity, but it's not gauge equivalent to a trivial connection. Okay, so that will be, so by ghost I mean exactly sort of transparent connections.
Are they somehow classified?
He didn't classify them, but I classify them in a more general setting than this, that I suspect includes his case. And his case is also covered by a theorem of Mason, Lyon and Mason. Essentially what happens is that if you have suitable decay at infinity, you can convert the problem in R2 to a problem on the two-sphere. And then it becomes now a question on the two-sphere. And this is what motivated Lyon and Mason to get into this. His examples come from mathematical physics. There is a kind of remarkable connection between all this and solutions to the Bogomolny equation in 2 plus 1 dimensions. So basically, he realized that the examples from this physicist were actually doing what he needed for his problem. He also shows local uniqueness, namely, these connections don't have very small curvature, they have kind of large curvature, a little bit like my sort of transparent connections that I will try to talk about in lecture 4. But this is a kind of pretty important, I would say, work. Difficult to read, but it's a nice paper. Okay, so maybe then I should mention then Lyon and Mason. This is related to 4. So he classifies transparent connections on H2 and RP2 with the usual metric. Unfortunately, Lyon and Mason never published his results. It's a shame. He told me that, you know, he has a sort of this draft one day he hopes to finish. His ideas are completely different. They go through along the lines of twister theory. That's where they are coming from, basically. Yeah, that's right. He does it. Yeah, well, okay, so you can reduce the Rn problem to a two-dimensional problem, essentially, if your background is flat, by taking totally geodesic slices. So really, it's just a two-dimensional question if your background is flat. And then, sorry? No, but the compactness is replaced by the suitable decay at infinity, which allows you to pass from R2 to R2 sphere. Sure, and this is, I wouldn't say topological, but I would say holomorphic reasons. Essentially what happens is that you start having, once you go to the two-sphere, and bundles of the two-sphere, more than one D-bar operator. So you have different holomorphic structures on your, even in the trivial bundle. That's the gadget that is responsible for all these ghosts. It's a holomorphic thing. It's a variety of holomorphic stuff. If you have a compact supporter on a disk, there's essentially only one D-bar operator. You can conjugate everything to one D-bar. But once you start having, so you let some sort of topology, then the number of D-bars, changes.
And
yes, and that's exactly what is responsible also in my work, and exactly what allows me to classify this guy in negative curvature. He doesn't quite phrase it that way, because he comes from these examples from mathematical physics, but if you go and read these examples in mathematical physics, it's the holomorphic structures on the bundles that's playing a role. And this is why Twister theory comes into play. Yes, there's a knot there that has to be, can be approached from many different angles. Okay, right, so that's, I don't think I missed anyone, but if I did, I'm sorry. So what I would like to do now is to give you an idea, well, to prove a, always on theorem B. Well, as I said, the n-dimensional case can be reduced to the two-dimensional case by taking slices, because flat is take planes and you can reduce it. But now your comment made me realize that Grigory Eskin also has results about theorem A for the attenuated ray transform in the flat. Okay. Right. The thing is that, you really need to prove theorem A new idea that wasn't present in any of this to unstuck you from either having a flat background or having the curvatures small enough. So you have to do something new, and this is what I would like to explain. Okay. So it has many bits, so I'm going to lay out all the various ingredients that come into play. I will explain how they all fit together, and then I will try to dispose of each one of them in turn. Okay? So the first thing that one needs is a sort of appropriate Fourier analysis in the fiberwise direction. So by that I mean, we are working on the unit sphere bundle over our surface, and the fibers are now circles. Yeah? So this fibers, the act, is a circle action, and the infinitesimal generator is what is called a vertical vector field. Which is generating the circle action on the fibers. So that's B. Now, we also have the geodesic vector field. And finally, there's a third vector field that completes a frame, which you can define on the unit tangent bundle of any surface, which you define, I'm going to call it X perp, which you define just simply as the Lie bracket of X and V. Yeah, the usual Lie bracket between two vector fields. Yeah, so. The nice thing about this is that they give you a frame. So if X is a geodesic vector field, they kind of, well, the way you have to think about them is that they look like this. Yeah? So going that way, you have the circles for your vibration, going that way, you have the orbit of your geodesic flow, and going that way, you have something that looks like a geodesic flow that has been rotated by 90 degrees. And this, so this, they make a frame of the tangent bundle to SM. Yeah, a nice frame, X, X perp, and V. And, you know, you want to do free analysis with respect to this V, because it's a circle action. Yeah. But before I go into that, and this is just sort of geometry of surfaces, there are two more bracket relations which are useful. So there are two more brackets relations, so there is a, which one can check. So one can check that the other two bracket relations are that X can be recovered from the bracket of V and X perp, and if you do the bracket of X and X perp, you get minus K times V, where K is the Gaussian curvature. So these are structure equations. Of the surface. Now, in this case, the Gaussian curvature. This you can find in any textbook in differential geometry. Okay. Great. So then I have this frame. So now I put, I can see there's a clever volume form over which I'm going to do the L2 theory. So I just say, for example, I'm going to declare this frame to be orthonormal. That gives me a Riemannian metric, and that Riemannian metric has a volume form. So I'm going to denote by d sigma 3 the volume form of SM coming from the Riemannian metric. Yes, it is the given measure, yes. Coming from the Riemannian metric, making this an orthonormal basis. It's the same as the given metric, it's the usual volume form that appears on the unit tangent bundle. So now the nice thing is that the three vector fields preserve the volume form. They have lead derivative zero. That's very simple to prove from the structure equations. Yeah? So once you have the brackets, so one thing to know is that X, X perp and V preserve the volume form. That's easy to check. Okay, so now therefore I have a nice inner product, an L2 inner product, so I can integrate on SM the, so if I have CN value functions, so this is the usual sort of Hermitian product in, Hermitian inner product in CN, which I integrate given two sections in there. So that means that I now have a nice L2 space, and since I have a circle action, that L2 space can decompose into the eigenvalues of the operator, self-adjoint operator IV, essentially. Because, yeah? I mean, the other thing that one can check is that this preserves the volume form, but they are all formally anti-symmetric. Yeah? So, one decomposes now this like that, so so if I look at minus IV on HN, you get just N times identity. So maybe I'll use K rather than N, because I'm using N for the for that, which is a mistake that I always make. Okay, great. So then a function now gets expanded. If a function, let's say, if a function in L2 gets expanded into Fourier series UK. So this UK belongs to HK. Okay. Now, once you have this, there is a fiberwise Hilbert transform, which is completely natural. It's the same one that appears in the work of Pestum and Ullmann. I'm going to use notation H like that. The notation is, unfortunately, throughout the papers, not uniform. Some papers call H the Jersey vector field, and they call the Hilbert transform something different. So I'm following the notation which are in the notes that I mentioned yesterday, and which are in the papers, proving these two theorems. Okay? So I'm calling this H, and what you do is you do it fiber-wise. So the way to define it is to say, well, it maps, I just have to tell you what it does on HK, on each one, and then you extend it by linearity. So it maps each one of these into, just get the sign right, minus the sign K times I times UK. So this is all you need to know. I mean, you can write down a formula, integral formula, I mean, but if I tell you what it does on each one of the eigenspaces, assuming, of course, that the sign of 0 is 0. So therefore, with this definition, it's immediate to check that the identity plus I times H applied to a function U, if you decompose it into a Fourier series, is the same as U naught plus 2 times the integral from, the sum from 1 to infinity of UK, and then it's U0 plus 2 integral from minus infinity to minus 1 of UK. Okay, so then it makes perfect sense to make the following definition. You now say that U is holomorphic if you only have positive Fourier coefficients. So basically, you want to essentially kill that. Yeah? So you just say that the identity minus I times the Fourier transform is U naught. An anti-holomorphic. Sorry? Constant along? Yes, so U naught is yes. So you can get it by taking the average of U, or just by, from the definition, is you apply V and you get zero, so it doesn't depend on the fiber. Absolutely. Anti-holomorphic if the identity minus IA plus U equals U naught. Okay. So that's great. Now, as some of you, I'm sure, heard before, this is a very nice formula, a very nice bracket relation between the Hilbert transform and the Jersey flow. Now, what we need is a version of that bracket relation that incorporates the connection. Because in the transport equation, it's an attenuated thing, so it's x plus a, yeah? So then the sort of second ingredient, which is very easy to check, is the following bracket relation. But if you do the bracket now between the Hilbert transform and x plus a of u, what you get is x perp plus star a u naught plus x perp plus vector A U dot. Yes. So if that happens, then the function which is and you fix x, the point on your manifold, then the function extends on the fiber to the inside of the circle. Sure. I was going to get into that, but is that then clear? Yeah. So I'll explain that in a second. Let me just say that if a is equal to zero, this is the usual Pestle-Wolman. Formula from the celebrated 2005 paper. Right, so how do we understand this again? So again, you have to think always that the A, here I'm thinking the A as is a function of x and v, so I evaluate it at a point there on the unit tangent bundle, and it acts on u by multiplication, yeah? So the u here is a infinity section. Star A is, star is a star operator of your Riemannian metric. So the Riemannian metric G has a star operator. The Riemannian metric G has a star operator that simply what it does to a one form is it maps it into another one form with the property that A, which star A is this times the area form. It's the usual Hodge star operator. Hodge star operator of G. So since this is a one form, star A is a new one form, yeah, so depends on x and v, and I evaluate that at xv. So this is really like, you know, you're shifting everything by 90 degrees. I mean, the star of a one form just shifts the form by 90 degrees. Another way to see that you can check, it's an amusing exercise, you can check that the star of A at a point xv is minus v of axv. So A depends linearly on the velocity, so you can differentiate it with respect. So this would be, you know, derivative respect to theta of A of x e to the I theta v. Yeah? That would be what you get by applying v. And since this depends linearly on this, this is nothing like minus x I v. Yeah? Well, you have, what I'm saying is that if you have a vector v, you rotate it by 90 degrees according to the orientation of the surface. You have a complex structure on the surface, not secretly, quite openly. And this is what it is, and all, I mean, it's obvious to check that this is equal to that. So this is all just an exercise. So this is quite nice, because then what pops up in the bracket formula is that the operator x plus a of the transport equation now goes into this. This is kind of flip, nice flip to x perp plus the star of a. Okay? The proof of this is based, it's an exercise, really. I mean, once you have the Hilbert transform like this, you just do it and you use, I mean, you can even do it simply by using first their formula if you don't want to do it again, and you just have to check what the Hilbert transform does with A, with the operator A times U. And this is quite simple. The same intuition that you get for the Pestle-Wolman formula. Does anyone have a good intuition for the Pestle-Wolman formula without the connection? Mikko, do you want to venture? Yeah. Yeah, but that's the kind of thing that you get only when you go and compute the formula, I guess. I mean, this is... I wish there were more... I mean... I guess the formula can become more transparent if you just do it on flat background, where you have an explicit formula. I mean, you always have an explicit formula for the geodesic vector field, actually, which is the way to prove this, is to sort of just write down this x in isothermal coordinates, and then it's very easy to check. No, because it has the wrong horizontal component. So the X perp is so
unrelated from other
metrics. Not on the base manifold. It is geodesic in a different sense, but you will not be able to get what you want because I mean the geodesic vector field essentially looks like this. It has a horizontal component which is essentially V and then zero. And this guy X perp is essentially IV zero, perhaps with a negative sign, I think. Yeah, so it has the wrong horizontal component, it's rotated. It's more like this is the vector field that you get when you know, the geodesic flow, you parallel transport the velocity vector. And this is the guy that you get when you sort of rotate and you parallel transport the other one, the one making a right angle. It's not the whole cyclic flow, no. To get the whole cycle flow, I'm actually, it's your fault. I mean, I'm a great fan of the whole cycle flow. You can get the whole cycle flow by doing a vertical perturbation of the geodesic flow. You have to add heat, so if you do it in the other, so the vertical vector field is this one, it's zero IV. So if you add a vertical perturbation to the geodesic flow, you get the whole cycle flow. Well, okay. And there are more than one way to look at the whole cycle flows, because it's a parabolic thing, and there's more than one. In the sense that, you know, they all conjugate, but you can see them in different ways. And depending how you look, you may get the one going this way with a right angle. But this is definitely not a whole cycle flow. In fact, this is, if X is an osso, X perp is also an osso. Whole cycle flow is parabolic. So you have to go in the other direction, vertical direction. Whole cycle flow is great. You can get it as a magnetic deformation of the geodesic flow. If you put some magnetic field on your surface and you increase intensity up to get to intensity 1, then you get the whole cycle flow, which is a wonderful object. Thoroughly recommend it. Okay, so, I mean, I wish I could say more agent to your question. Has Gunther ever given you any sort of formal intuition for the bracket that one can actually relate with? I mean, I can understand it because I'm checking myself. You know, I like this definition. I mean, with this definition of a Hilbert transform, it's very simple to check. Right, the third thing that we need, which I think this I probably won't have much time to say, is it's a technical thing. It's a regularity result, which more or less says the following. If you have a function in the kernel of the ray transform, and this is actually for an arbitrary f, if you have something in the kernel of the ray transform, then u solving the transport equation which is now the u vanishing on the boundary completely is smooth. So in principle, the solution of the transport equation has this problem of smoothness at vectors when you solve the transport equation, usually the u has a smoothness problem at vectors like that. It's okay in all the other vectors, but it has a problem there, which is kind of easy to see why this problem arises, because, I mean, if you come from vectors from this side, basically the time it takes for a geodesic to exit is nothing, and the moment you kind of move, something happens. So the solutions of the transport equation kind of have a sort of problem there, which is a very well-known problem. It turns out that when the U is actually zero on the entire boundary, which is to say that the transform is zero, you can actually check that the U solving the transport equation is a smooth function. So again, this is a sort of, it's an enhancement of something that was present in the paper by Pestov and Ullmann, studying the regularity of the solutions to the transport equation without the attenuation. Okay, so that's a sort of technical thing. And now comes something really sort of important, an important ingredient, which is, I'm hoping to prove this, is the existence of holomorphic integrating factors for scalar case. So suppose that let A be a scalar one form. Yeah? So not matrix value. Not matrix value. But just, you know, taking values in C. Then there exists W holomorphic and smooth. So when I say holomorphic, remember it's holomorphic in the vertical variable, and when I say smooth, it's smooth as a function from Sn into Cn, such that that happens. And the same for anti-holomorphic. Okay, so part of the reason why we're stuck with this problem for quite a long time is because we don't know if the statement of this proposition is true for systems. I mean, okay, so stated like that is obviously true. You have a matrix, you just solve it one by one, but you know, you really want these guys to be to become integrating factors in the sense that later on we're going to be looking at the exponential of omega. Yeah, and we're going to be differentiating this. And when you have matrices, you know, there's a problem with doing this. Yeah, for quite a long time we were stuck with that. But fortunately, as I will try to explain, there is a way to overcome that difficulty. Okay, so this, I'll try to sort of explain how this comes into play. And then there is an L2 identity. So that's, I think, the...
Sorry, I'm afraid I don't understand. So where?
It's a scalar one form on M. Yeah. So therefore, it's a function also in Tn. Yeah, because it's a one form. So it's the entries of A, so... XV. Yeah, you have the one form and you apply it to V. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. So, in fact, if you want another way to think about it, since you asked that, a one form, if you decompose it in Fourier series, will have a component in H minus 1 and H1. And if it is a real value one form, then one is the conjugate of the other. Yeah. And so if you like, in more sort of Riemann surfaces terms, the elements in HK are sections of the powers of the canonical line bundle. Corresponds to this sort of, yeah. Right. And the fifth is a special L2 identity, which is, it's a variation of the Pestov identity, and it says the following. So it says that if you have a smooth function vanishing completely on the boundary of Sm, which we are going to have if we have something solving the transport equation with zero rate and zero attenuated rate transform, then we have the following identity. Okay, so these norms are, and the inner products are all in the L2 inner product, so these are integrals, yeah? Okay, so let's see if this is clear. So I have u, I apply v, and then apply the operator x plus I. So this is kvu, and now comes the curvature of the connection. So there are two curvatures into play, curvature of the connection, curvature of the surface. The curvature of the connection, remember I defined it last time, is a two form, so I can also apply to that the star. Is the curvature of the connection A? Yes, of course, yeah. So FA, we defined it last time as TA plus A wedge A. It's a two form, so now you apply the star operator and it takes your function. Or another way to think about this, if you like, since this is a two form, it's a function times the area form. Yeah, so you can write it in a sort of, well, this is the area form of G. And this becomes just a function of X, this star FA. Okay, now this is, I hope maybe I have to do it next time. But this is or can be proved in a very similar way to what Mika was explaining today with the Kalman estimate, this L2 identity with a P and a P star and a commutator. Comes from that. I mean, curvature always comes from a commutator. But this is amazing. I mean, these special type identities are they're amazing in my view. Okay, so these are the ingredients. So let me try to explain a little bit how they fit together in the remaining half hour. Okay, everyone happy so far then with the, I mean I haven't put them together so now it looks a bit odd, but hopefully now we'll come. Yes, I'm hoping to prove that, yes. Yes. So I'm hoping to prove everything except 3 and 2, the bracket relationship of the calculation. And for 5, I will give some intuition about the details of the calculation. Maybe I won't do it completely, but just enough so you can see where it comes from. Okay. Okay, so to get the proof going, I need an auxiliary result. Okay, so the first thing that I'm going to prove is the following. So suppose you have a solution to the transport equation like that, vanishing on the boundary completely. And you suppose that the Fourier coefficients of the k, of the f, are 0 for k less than or equal than minus 2. Yeah, let's start with that. We'll see in a minute why this is useful. Yeah, so I'm taking this is an arbitrary f, arbitrary smooth f, and I assume that the f is almost holomorphic. It has some extra bit in minus 1 degree, in the degree minus 1, which I will show you it doesn't really matter. Okay, and then the statement is that under that hypothesis, if this is negative definite, for all x, then u is holomorphic. And similarly, if I star FA is positive definite, then U is anti-holomorphic. Two comments. Remember, this is a skew Hermitian matrix, so if you multiply by I, it becomes a Hermitian matrix. So it makes perfect sense to talk about being positive definite. What's the idea of all this, really? The idea is to sort of look at this identity. So some things here come with a sign, yeah, because they are positive just because they are L2 norms. Yes, the things that do not have signs are this. Now, I'm going to try to convince you that the hypothesis of being simple implies that this guy over here is always greater than or equal than zero. Greater than or equal to zero, because of the absence of conjugate points. I'll try to explain that. That somehow comes from the metric. Now, the problem with this is that we don't have any sort of control, in a way. And this is the reason why in Sharafuddin versions of the proof and so on, he requires some smallness somewhere, even though he doesn't go along these lines, but you know, it all comes to trying to sort of control this term. The way we're going to control this term is by changing the connection in a suitable way, using some sort of trick, which is pretty common in complex geometry. Is that, you know, you have a connection, and essentially what you want to add is, you know, a suitable connection with curvature that will dominate the stuff that you don't know, and will produce a sign on this term. The problem is that once you introduce this new connection, you have to deal with that, yeah? And the way to deal with that is we're going to gauge it away with this holomorphic integrating factor. That's the idea. And because we are able to choose how much we alter the... So especially, you know, we have the transport equation and we are going to attenuate it even further, but we start controlling the curvature. And we're going to do it two ways, positive and negative, basically. And this is where this theorem is going to come. Okay, you'll see it in a minute. But that's roughly the sort of idea. Is we are going to control the curvature by adding stuff that will kill it, basically. And then we're going to get that stuff away, move that stuff away, or gauge it away with holomorphic integrating factors from proposition 4. And we're going to have it to do it two ways. Yeah, that's the way we control the curvature of the connection. It corresponds to these statements in complex geometry that they say, you know, that if you twist a sort of line vector bundle or a line bundle sufficiently enough with enough positivity, some ampleness, you will dominate, you will produce a vanishing of something. This is kind of more or less what happens here, but at the geodesic flow level, basically. So it's a, yeah. Okay, so let me see now in detail how to prove this theorem and how to complete the proof of the previous one. Okay, so what do we need to show? Well, I'm just going to show also only the first bit, but if it's negative definite, then it's holomorphic, the other one is just a mirror proof. Okay. Okay, so to show that U is holomorphic, what do we need to prove? We need to prove that if I apply this operator to U, I get U naught. This was our definition of being holomorphic. Yeah, or in other words, that this only depends on X, which is the same thing. Yeah? Another way is to say that this only depends on X. It's an equivalent way to saying that it's equal to U naught. Okay, so then to prove that, let's apply X plus A. We apply X plus A to that. And here we use the bracket. Okay, so first, so for the first bit, okay, so maybe, so X plus A, I get X plus A of U, of course, minus I, and then X plus A of H U. Now, this X plus A of U is minus F, because U is solving the transport equation. And this one, I can use the bracket. So I use now the bracket. And I get something like this, minus I. Sorry? Why not? Because I'm not going to. Okay. So, yeah, so. Okay, so. Right. And now, one nice thing about this is that, okay, so let's see. So here I have again another x plus a u, so that's minus f. So I can collect this minus f with this one, and I get minus identity of minus I h f. And then the rest, I don't need to write it in any detail. I just have to say, what is this? Well, this is a function that depends only on the base point, and I'm applying x perp plus star a. So this guy will just simply be a one form. It's linear in B, this one. And this one is just a function on x, because it's a zero component. Yeah? So I get this term plus something which I can write function on x plus a one form. I don't want to know what the formula is, but that's what happens. Okay, now I use the hypothesis on f. My f has zero Fourier coefficients. Sorry, maybe I should be lifting this. My f has zero Fourier coefficients for k less than or equal than 2. So that means that when you compute that, what you get is just simply minus f naught minus 2 f of minus 1, if you compute this term. Okay, so the whole outcome of this is just is a function of x plus a one form. Okay, right, so now I want to apply the Pestov identity . So I want to apply the identity 5 to the function v equals that. Yes? So what I have proved is that that's v. What I have proved is that x plus a of v is a function of x plus a one form. Right? So now let's see what happens when you apply a function of x plus a one form to this identity. Okay, now, but now the u here should be v. Okay? Now, if this is a function plus a one form, when you apply v, you only keep the one form. This is a function plus a one form, so it's the function plus a one form. But the square of this, functions and one forms are in orthogonal component, is the norm of the one form plus the norm of the zero form. Okay? But the, I want to say something a little bit more general, which is very easy to check. So if we do V of a one form, the norm square of this is the same as the norm of the one form. Because, you know, the only thing that you do when you apply V is change V plus IV. So the norm remains the same. So therefore, this term in the right-hand side, becomes essentially the norm of a function with a negative sign. Yeah? So remind you again, this just picks up V of the one form, and this is the norm of the one form plus the zero component. The ones from the one forms cancel, and you only pick up the one from the function, but that comes with a negative sign. So therefore, the right-hand side is less than or equal to zero. Okay, great. So now, this term is a term that I promise I'm going to eventually show to you that is always greater than or equal to zero because of the non-simple points, the non-conjugate point condition. So that's x plus a the U. You're going to have to trust me in this one until you see a proof, but... Thank you very much. It's true for any U, in fact. But, okay. So, because M has no conjugate points. So, proof later. Okay, so then, therefore, the only thing that remains is this. That term to control. So this has less than or equal than zero, this has greater than or equal than zero, and this comes out with the right sign that you need under the hypothesis of the theorem. Because this you can now compute, this I can compute in an explicit way. But now we can compute, so V, which is the identity minus IH, applied to U. So remember this was U0 plus 2 times minus infinity minus 1 of UK. So this is actually very easy to compute. I mean, this is just applying the vertical vector to V, which when you apply to UK, it's just IKUK. Yeah? This only depends on X. This is only depends on X. So therefore, you can compute this quite in an explicit form, and you get this minus 4 times if you arrange the signs correctly, you get that. I think that's correct. Okay, so now this is greater than or equal to zero. This, if you move it to the other side, was also greater than or equal to zero. So therefore, this one has to be greater than or equal to zero. Yeah? So I think that's perfect, yeah? Because now you say, maybe I got it. So I got the signs wrong, yes? I want to, yes, I'm claiming that this is, let's see, that this is less than zero, but unfortunately I have a negative k now that I'm seeing this. Ah, no, that's exactly what I want. So, yeah, so that negative sign with that negative k gives me the right sign to be able to claim that all of this must be zero with the hypothesis that I have on my I. Yeah, so I'm assuming the I negative definite, yeah, so it is correct. Yes. Yes, so this implies now, because I am assuming the I star F negative definite, that all the UKs must be zero. All the UKs in the right range. And that's exactly what I want. Yes, so the first time is greater than or equal to zero. This, yeah, so you move it to the other side, and you move this one to the other side, and you end up having that one is greater than or equal to zero. Yes, so this comes then, this comes from five. Yeah. Well, I'm assuming that this is negative definite. So this is negative definite, I have negative, negative k. So the only way this could all agree is if all the uk's are zero. No, because these are inner products and therefore they are integrals. So it has to be all over the surface. Yeah, yeah, this I star FA is just a matrix. is just a Hermitian matrix which you apply, you know, at every x to the function u x, and then you integrate.
Point-wise.
Sorry?
Point-wise.
I am demanding this point-wise. No, this is okay. I mean, that's a weaker thing. That's what you're saying. But I mean, this will do.
Yes.
Okay. Got you now. Yeah. Okay. So that's. Let's see if that works. Sorry. Okay. So now let's complete the scheme of the proof. Deal with that now. Great, okay. So how does the proof go? Now, how do we implement this idea of arranging the curvature to have the right sign to be able to use this proposition? Okay? And this is the way I do it. So now this is finally proof of theorem A. Okay, so I look at the area form of M. Yeah? So M is a disk. Okay? Topologically. So therefore any form is exact. So the area form has a primitive. So I take omega G to be d phi, where phi is a 1-4. So what's the idea now? Well, this is the sort of trick in sort of complex geometry, if you like. If you take I'm going to define a one-parameter family of connections, and then going one side and the other side of the real line. So given a parameter S, I look at a one-parameter family of connections, unitary connections, given by A minus IS, phi times the identity. So this is a real form. This is a real valued. Real value form. So if I do that, I get a nice unitary connection. What's the point of doing this? Well, the point of doing this is that now the curvature is very easy to compute. The curvature of this connection is just simply going to be the curvature of A. And if you remember just the formula, it's just taking d a which a. So if you do that, you get the curvature of a minus is omega g times the identity. Because, you know, you're going to have to take d, but I've chosen phi to be a primitive of the area form. Okay? So therefore, if you do star of a s, you get star of a, but star of the area form is just 1. So you get minus IS times the identity. Then of course, if I take S large enough, I can dominate this and make it negative. And if I take S large enough but with opposite sign, I can make this positive, definitely. Yeah. So the sort of idea now is that for S bigger than S naught, we can make star of IS being negative. And for S less than minus S naught, we can make star of IS with an I to be positive. So that way we can arrange our curvature to have sign. The issue is, you know, getting rid of that. Okay, so now I choose, right, so, oh yeah, okay, so remember that, you know, we are trying to show, understand this, so there is a smooth U, doing that, which vanishes in the boundary. Okay, great, so now, I use now the proposition with the holomorphic integrating factors, so from proposition, from 4, I know that there exists omega holomorphic such that x omega equals I phi. Yeah, so now I choose a holomorphic integrating factor for the primitive of my area. Okay, so why is that good? Because now, if I let us be the function e to the s omega u, then you compute that, x plus as applied to us, and what you get is that this is just simply minus e to the s omega times f. This is just a calculation, because you can see it, I mean, how it happens. Just apply x to us. You have to differentiate an exponential. That's where you use that x omega equals minus I phi. And then the other term is just xu, which solves equal to f. So what I have done is I have attenuated further, yeah, but in a convenient way, by adding this extra ig. What have I accomplished with that? Well, this is great now, because if omega is holomorphic, e to the s omega continues to be holomorphic. Yeah. So therefore, when you multiply f, so remember our f was, our function f was a function plus a one form. If you multiply a function plus a one form by something holomorphic, yes, you don't create new Fourier coefficients from minus 2 downwards. Yes, so what I'm trying to say is that because this is holomorphic, because omega is holomorphic, this happens. So now I'm in perfect condition to apply the previous theorem. Yes, because I have, the other thing you have to say, of course, is that us on the boundary of Sm is also zero, of course, because u is. Okay, so then the argument goes like this. Now you choose an s large enough so that the curvature of the connection as, I think if I want to go that way, has that sign, if you want. Okay, so for that choice of s, you do this calculation, and you use the previous term. Yeah? This will force then the function us to be holomorphic. So by the theorem, us is holomorphic. But if us is holomorphic, u is holomorphic, because u is just us times e to the minus s omega. Okay, so therefore u is holomorphic. But now, you can do the mirror argument and show in exactly the same way that u is also anti-holomorphic. Yes, you go the other way, and you do the whole mirror thing by doing the curvature in the opposite, going the other way. So then u has to be both holomorphic and anti-holomorphic. And therefore it's a function only of the position, and that's all you need, all you wanted to prove. So now you just say, so I'll just write that. Let me write that down. Have a few minutes still, so it's not rush. So I just say, so choose S less than minus S naught, such that I star of A is less than 0. By the previous theorem, US is holomorphic, but U is U to the minus S omega times US, which is also holomorphic. And similarly, by taking s bigger than s naught, we prove but you is something with me. Yes? No. No, yes, I corrected that twice. Yeah, yes, you need, you're trying to show that it's anti-holomorphic, so you want this to claim that it's anti-holomorphic. Yeah. Prove that U is anti-holomorphic, therefore U equals U naught. And if U equals U naught, then from the transport equation, if U equals U naught, X U becomes just du, and therefore F is just du plus AU, so you just have to pick P equals minus U. Yeah, so that's the idea, yeah? So is this, so you notice how, we are using just the holomorphic integrating factors really for the scalar case by making this sort of one parameter perturbation of the connection. And this way we can arrange the sign of the curvature and then the Pestov identity takes over and somehow produces the vanishing we want. In the formula in the Pestov identity, if you remember, it was an L2 identity, you need U to vanish on the boundary, because it comes, since we were talking about that yesterday, from integration by parts in a way, so you want the boundary terms when you use Stokes to go away, essentially, or Green's, or whatever, your favorite version, and for that you need the function to vanish on the boundary. So it's used, and maybe there were places in which I should have said that on the various operations, I said it here, but the function is always vanishing on the boundary. Make sense? Yeah? Okay, so I think there's no point in sort of pushing with more proof now. So maybe what I'll do is, if you have questions, we can discuss questions now. And then I promise that for next time, I will prove the existence of these holomorphic integrating factors. I'll give you an idea. This comes from the surjectivity of the ray transform on zero on functions. From the surjectivity of the adjoint, of the ray transform on zero functions. I'll try to explain the important, very important thing where the fact of being simple comes into play here. From the non-conjugate points, there's a very nice way of kind of explaining this. And then I say a few words about how to get the Pestov identity from sort of arguments that Mika was doing this morning with this sort of Kalman estimates. Okay? And so that will take me probably half of tomorrow, and then I'll do the other half with an application of all these ideas to a tensor tomography problem, in which we have not an attenuated ray transform, but the usual one, but the way to go is actually to attenuate it, to solve an attenuated one, which is kind of counterintuitive, but I'll do that tomorrow, okay? For the? When you don't have a surface, you mean?
No, it's
CM. Yes. That's the whole point. I put the identity here. So the matrix that I'm adding here is the identity matrix times some scalar. But this guy here is your favorite matrix, your favorite connection on CN for an arbitrary N. Yes. Yeah. Isn't it like this in the proof of the Kolyaya vanishing? That if you twist with a line bundle, no matter what the size of your vector bundle, you always win somehow. If you twist enough. So that he amounts to taking the S large enough. It's just to get the order right.
I think that's not
it.
Okay, it will be
mine. No, it confuses me. It confuses me for a long time. So the way you do this is first you sort of split it up.
Yes, that's obviously the easiest.
So this gives you the best of. So for this one, you use the one
that's the. It just because, sorry, do you understand it just because it's a writing space for V?
Yes.
So you can have this for V.
Ah, so you want to prove for this one?
No, this just goes from V. That V and...
No, this you have to do it. It's not entirely obvious.
No.
I mean, the way I see it, the best way to prove it is that you write the X in isothermal coordinates.
Uh-huh.
There's a formula for it. It's important to see the formula.
Right, yes.
Cos theta v over the x, and this is the vertical vector here.
Right.
Once you have the formula, it's quite simple, because all you have to do is, if you have a function u,
so x bar will be just what? It will be minus sine cos here, right?
The x part?
Yeah.
Ah, the x part? Yes, you change the sign here. Is that if you were doing, you were multiplying by 90 degrees.
Yes. Sine minus
yes. And
here is the right.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
So yes, that's right.
Yeah, okay.
So once you have this, then the only thing that you do is you check it on each one of the HKs.
Right.
On a function HK. Yeah, because I mean, so the HK will, you can check that this will give you some component in K minus 1 and a component in K plus 1. So you know what H of that each one of these is.